Satea's face fell in disgust. You reject Pharaoh's request? Surely you know his wrath is legendary.
Masili let a weighty silence pass.
Oh, yes, I know. And so, too, I am led to believe, does the Hittite nobleman Teti.
Satea's head retracted at the apparent non sequitur.
What?
Teti was a loyal and good-hearted member of my Panku. A friend, a comrade, and a damned fine envoy. 2 years ago, I dispatched him to Memphis to speak with Pharaoh.
Masili's eyes darkened under his dipping brow.
Yet he never returned. Some say he now languishes there in a cell, beaten, naked, and forgotten.
Satea's lips receded over his gums in anger.
Such words blacken my master's name. When Pharaoh hears of this affront, you know what will happen.
Masili, great king of the Hittites, glowered at him.
War, he mused. War is an inevitability. It is only a question of when, as you have proved today. And when it comes, it will be the cruelest war ever waged, and the gods will gather to watch.
He sucked in a deep breath and boomed,
Pharaoh will surely hear of this, but not from your poisoned lips. Just as Teti never returned to me, neither will you return to Egypt.
Satea's face fell blank for an instant. Then, at the slightest movement of Masili's index finger, a pair of Mercedes lunged up the steps and seized the Egyptian by the shoulders. Gasps and whispers filled the hall.
Take him to the Well of Silence,
Masili boomed, standing. The grim underground jail, lying east of Hattusa, would provide the brazen messenger with an eternity of darkness and quiet with which to reflect upon matters. Satea spat some jagged volley of oaths in his native tongue, struggling to free himself from the grasp of the Mercedes as they dragged him down the steps, until Zeta rose from his place by the throne and strode over to whack him on the back of the head with a small cudgel. As the Egyptian's limp form was dragged from the hall through a small hatch door, the whispers of the crowd exploded into a babble of shock and intrigue. With a sharp clap of Masili's hands, the din ceased.
Loyal kings, remain here with me,
he said, struggling to control the still strong tremor of rage in his voice.
The rest of you, I bid you outside to the feast.
He gestured towards the doorway, beyond which a skirl of pipes had struck up. Hattu slunk quietly out of the hall amongst the masses, all gossiping avidly about what had just happened. Ranks of long, low, food-festooned feasting tables now lined the twilit ward. People took their places and the entertainment began. Acrobats and dancers spilled across the center of the feasting area, bearing torches, ropes, and hoops. The pipers now belted out a fast, frantic tune as the acrobats took to leaping and twisting, setting light to the hoops and diving through them. Two dancers held a rope taut between them, while a third edged along it on his toes. As Hattu made his way around the spectacle, a painted man at one of the feasting tables stopped talking and stared at him as he chewed on a leg of goose, grease staining his chin and food scum clinging to his teeth.
Would you dare to glower at the Labana? Or my brothers like that? Hattu thought to himself.
Another fellow took a long gulp of expensive Amurite wine, eyeing Hattu over the rim of his cup, then whispered something to the painted one. Hattu read his lips over the skirling pipes.
The cursed sun, the man said, but in Sumerian, an ancient language.
The painted one nodded in agreement, then scraped up a handful of honeyed nuts and shoveled them into his meat-stained maw, crunching into them with a dismissive laugh. The pair probably expected that Hattu, a prince, knew nothing of the tongue. It was, after all, the job of a scribe to understand and translate the many languages of the world for their kings and people. For the first time in a while, Hattu silently thanked the gods and Ruba for his confinement to the scribal school.
You eat like pigs, and smell like them too,
he whispered in Sumerian as he passed the pair. The two gawped, faces blanching further under all the paint. A brief glow of pride burnt off Hattu's anger. An arm wrapped over his shoulders, Ah, brother, there you are. Come, let us sit, Muwa said, guiding him through the chattering throngs and clacking cups towards a table. Hattu looked up, seeing the empty benches there.
Why there?
He started. Then saw exactly why. On the opposite side sat the young priestess of poverty, Atiya. She toyed nervously with the braided tail of black hair that hung from her scarlet headscarf and sat across the breast of her pleated temple robes. The amber hoop she wore in her ears shook gently as she shot timid, dimpled smiles around the crowd, and the copper moon amulet on her chest sparkled in the torchlight. She was closer to Muwa's age than his, but it never felt that way. There was something about Atiya that instantly lifted his heart. Perhaps it was her sepia skin, or maybe her eyes, full sable pools. Atiya's parents had been killed by the Kaskans years before, and he had always felt a need to protect her. As they approached the table, Hattu felt himself shrink in his step, suddenly self-conscious. Why on earth had he not first returned to his chamber in the palace to find a pair of boots or a clean tunic? His bare, grazed and grubby chest and arms looked even scrawnier when set against the many older boys and men suited in ceremonial armour. Atiya hadn't noticed them approaching yet, so he tried to mimic Muwa's tall, confident stride, pushing his shoulders back and tilting his head up a little to give him a fraction more height, throwing his legs out with each stride purposefully. She noticed them then, eyes widening in delight.
Muwa, she said, standing.
Her beaming smile grew lopsided, and she tilted her head.
Hattu, why are you strutting like a deranged peacock?
Muwa burst into laughter, and Hattu's face creased in anger. Few spoke to the two princes with such candour. He pointed to Muwa, as if to blame him, but his words died in a tangled stutter. Atiya stretched over the table to accept Muwa's embrace and the delicate kiss he placed on the back of her hand. Hattu felt a fiery spike of injustice at this, and at the coquettish look she gave his older brother. He stretched out to embrace her too, but found he was a little too short to reach, and had to make do with the motherly kiss she planted on his head instead, the kind offered to a child who has just settled down after a tantrum.
But damn, he thought, slumping onto the bench. Is this the gathering? Or the humiliation of Hattu?
A panicked shriek sounded from the acrobat display. One of the fire dancers was rolling on the ground, his kilt ablaze. The crowd offered the fellow sympathetic laughter, one man deigning to toss his cup of wine over the thrashing wretch, who then suffered the ignominy of staggering away, kilt reduced to ashes, exposed buttocks burnt angry red.
Aye, well, it could be worse, Hattu grinned.
Next, a troop of bulging wrestlers came on, dressed in just loincloths. They coated their skin in oil, tied their hair up in tight knots, and proceeded to twist seven spadefuls of agony out of one another with a series of grunts, cracks, and pops of bone and cartilage. Hattu turned away and gazed over the fare on offer. Sweet loaves, slabs of pure white goat's cheese peppered with chopped coriander, joints of goose and venison, figs, ruby-red pomegranates, chunks of honey in the comb, and rows of foaming beer cups and huge urns of wine. Hunger swept away his annoyance. He reached over to take a sweet loaf, still warm, pouring a little oil on it, then breaking it in two and biting off a chunk. Syrupy, soft and fragrant, it instantly reinvigorated him. He wondered what he could talk to Atiya about. She was already in conversation with Muwa, intrigued by his recent trips to the southern cities. He spotted some hen's eggs on the table, and this suddenly reminded him of his efforts that afternoon. He rummaged in his bag and presented the falcon egg across the table like a prize. But Atiya was oblivious, for Muwa had offered her something first.
For you,
Muwa said, pressing a white linen purse into her hand. She pulled the cord and out fell a small silver brooch in the shape of a lion's head, its eyes picked out with twilight blue lapis stones. The elder priestess and a few others nearby cooed in wonder.
I cannot accept this,
Atiya gasped.
You cannot refuse, Muwa replied instantly, closing her hand over the piece.
It was crafted in faraway Troy,
by the hand of King Alexandru's finest silversmith, more delicate than anything the artisans of Hattusa might sweat, solder, or hammer. I had it commissioned whilst in Troy last year, during the last months of the Arzawan War. King Alexandru brought the finished piece with him today.
Muwa, you make me burn with embarrassment. I'm not worth such a treasure.
Muwa grinned, cocking his head slightly until she smiled. Oh, it was worth it. If only to see you smile. Atia clasped the brooch to the breast of her robe, looking around timidly as if expecting someone to scoff at her. Muwa began to recount some other memories of his time fighting in the West. The Arzawan War was grueling, he mused, with the poise of a seasoned warrior, swishing his wine cup and gazing into the distance as he described the battles and the distant lands. Atia seemed lost in his words. Hattu found himself drawn into Muwa's tale also. Talk suggested the chosen prince would soon lead a division in his own right, as a general, like Kurunta or Nwanza. This was Hattu's 12th summer, and father seemed loath to be in his presence, let alone discuss his future. Muwa flicked his head to one side and clicked his tongue as he concluded his recollections.
Aye, it was a hard-won war, but the Arzawan League is gone.
Thanks mainly to you, Atia said.
Her fawning words were belied by the playful glint in her eyes and the way her ruby tongue played with a small gap in her pearl-white teeth. Muwa reddened ever so slightly.
Well, I don't mean I...
Atia looked at Hattu now, winking to share her mischief. Hattu's heart soared at the momentary attention. Then she noticed the falcon egg.
My goodness, what a comely shell, she cooed. It is for you, he said,
sounding unflustered in comparison to Muwa.
He found it out in the woods, when he should have been at the scribal school, Muwa clarified,
reaching to ruffle his younger brother's hair. But Hattu ducked out of the way, stretching over to place the egg in Atia's hands.
It will not hatch, he said,
noticing how warily she held it.
I found it whilst climbing,
he started, then raised his voice a little, casting Muwa a sideways glance.
At the top of a ridge? A high ridge? Hattu, you must be careful.
She shot him a reproachful look.
Men have fallen to their deaths from those heights. It was worth it to see you smile, he said,
hoping Atia wouldn't spot the obvious imitation of his brother's line. Atia laughed, but shuffled awkwardly.
Muwa, Hattu, I...
Sarpa hobbled up behind them, resting his crutch against the bench and scooping his hands over his brother's shoulders.
Brothers, what Atia is trying to say is, she thinks you are but a pair of goats.
Hattu chuckled and Muwa shot him a quizzical look.
Goats? Funny you should choose to liken us to goats, Muwa said. Did you ever tell Atia about the time when you were a boy and you tried to ride on a goat's back?
No,
Sarpa said, straightening up and plucking a cherry from the table before hobbling away promptly.
The goat threw him, Muwa smirked, raising his voice so Sarpa would be sure to hear. Tossed him into a trough of dung.
Atia laughed, then eyed both.
But Sarpa is right. Stop bringing me things. I need nothing. If you have to bring gifts, then bring them as offerings to the temple grounds. The gods are more befitting of them than I.
In the eyes of some, perhaps, Muwa said,
rising and taking Atia's hand to kiss it once more.
Now I must leave you. Father asked me to eat swiftly, then rejoin his talks.
Hattu watched as his brother returned to the Hall of the Sun. For the brief moment the tall doors were opened, he heard raised voices within, the conversation sharp and salty. When the doors banged shut, Hattu felt a great sadness.
And how is Arrow?
Atia said, mercifully drawing his attentions back to her. She could read him like a clay tablet, Hattu realized. He looked over to the royal palace at the north end of the Acropolis, where Arrow had made a nest on the sill of his upper-floor bedchamber. Old Ruba's beloved pony, Onyx, was tethered underneath, and seemed to be engaged in some conversation with Arrow, he nickering, she screeching.
No doubt hungry,
he confessed.
I will be back shortly,
he said, gathering up some strands of meat and rising, warmed again by her smile. He traipsed on towards the palace. It was largely dark and silent, but something caught his eye. The high balcony at the southwestern corner of the royal dwelling. He'd never been on it, or in the dark adjoining room. The Black Room, as it was known, was always locked. Father never allowed anyone to enter that chamber. He'd even beaten Hattu for approaching it. He gazed up at the balcony sadly. Then he was overcome with a chill, for up there he saw some dark rippling shape, writhing like a living shadow, floating. The movement faded, then all was still again. He had seen the likes a few times before. Just what was up there? He had asked Ruba once, and the old tutor had replied, The king's demons live in that high room. With a shiver and a nervous gulp, he eyed the palace wall, contemplating a climb up there to see these demons for himself. But the plasterwork was recent and utterly smooth. Even the best climber would be confounded. When he impressed Ruba again on what was up there, the old tutor had replied,
You will have to ask your father, lad.
But how could he ask his father about the Black Room, about anything when the king despised him so, left him out of everything? Overcome with angry defiance, he swung round to glower at the Hall of the Sun with a sour eye, thinking of father, Muwa, and the many kings within. The doors were locked, two golden spearmen standing vigil before them. His eyes drifted to the corner of that building. Unlike the palace, there were creases in the stonework foundations and full wrinkles in the mud brick section higher up, leading to one of the high-up arched windows that lit the hall. This he could climb.
If father won't invite me to the talks, he mused with a recalcitrant half-smile.
It was as if a spell was upon him. He scuttled over, hugging the shadows until he reached the foot of the throne room walls. Then up he went. A moment later he was halfway up, the climb easy and the holds regularly spaced. He began traversing sideways, over the grand doorway and the heads of the oblivious golden spearmen, then up towards one high window. He clambered onto the dusty broad stone sill, settling there, peering down into the Hall of the Sun like a crow. Muwa and 33 uniquely dressed monarchs and lords were gathered around the foot of the throne in an arc, facing the throne dais. Two Misedi and Zida stood before the platform like a screen. General Nuanza, the coal-haired colossus, stood at the side of the hall with a trio of sentries. But where was the demon Karunta One-Eye? Hattu wondered. He leaned ever closer, searching the hall for the missing general, when a shard of loose stone scraped under his foot and a tiny puff of grit and dust spat out from the sill, toppling down into the throne room. Instantly, the eyes of the Misedi, Nuanza, Zida, and the king shot up like flaming arrows about to be loosed. He ducked down and lay still with fright. Masili saw nothing but starlit darkness up there. Zida gave him a shrug, but kept his tapered eyes on the window for a moment longer. The king returned to his thoughts, rubbing his temples, still trying to put shape to what had occurred with the Egyptian diplomat.
The Egyptian borders must be reinforced, Prince Muwa repeated urgently.
Masili half nodded. With the crowds gone, it was a time for stark truths. His thoughts shifted to the other great threat in those lands.
And what of our frontier with the Assyrian Empire?
He muttered, glancing down at a young Hittite nobleman who had travelled from the southeast.
The fortress of Gargamis watches over the river Marla ford like a stone giant. Viceroy Shahuru's garrison is small but skilled, and he sends his thanks to you for your gift of chariots, he replied. But the Assyrians, they, like the Egyptians, are not for accepting our presence there.
He scanned the arc of men and found those he was looking for, the allied kings of Ugarit, Nuhashi, Amaru, and Kadesh, each vassal commanding a small army and a small buffer territory in northern Retinue, each a vital protector of the precious tin root. He recalled and cringed at his hubris-fueled words to the Egyptian earlier on.
And extra weapons? I have no need for them. Have you seen my divisions in their pomp?
They shine and clatter, heavy with sharpened bronze of their own. The truth was far bleaker. Tin reserves were scarce, perilously so. I count upon you, loyal kings, to be my eyes in the east, to keep the tin trade route open, lest my bronze smith's forges grow dim and cool. Zeda seemed a little perturbed by his stark words in front of these unreliable kings.
Are mine at Kestel, just a half moon's ride to the south, still holds some tin, my son? We are not entirely dependent on the trade routes through retinue.
Massili gave his gal Mercedes a dry half-grin. The last attainable seams at Kestel were mined generations ago. Remember what happened when my father tried to dig further to the deepest seams? Regardless, he let Zeda's tactical fiction resonate.
Perhaps, but in any case, the southern edge of that land must be watched carefully. Should the Egyptian pharaoh prove as brave with his actions as he is with his words, and clumsy theatre, then I must know as soon as possible.
The leathery-skinned king of Ugarit answered first.
It will be done, my son.
Massili made a faint noise of agreement. Then his thoughts swung from east to west.
And what of western Anatolia?
He asked King Alexandru. Alexandru stood tall, clearing his throat.
Unrest prevails, my son. Ahioan brigands roam the Siha Riverlands, encroaching on Wiluzan territory as if there is no code of law.
Massili felt the rising heat of agitation. The myriad city-states across the western sea, Mycenae, Pylos, Thebes, Sparta, Tiryns, Ithaca, Argos, and many more dotted across the rocky, broken, and strange peninsula known as Ahioa, had formed some sort of warlike coalition. The feather-crowned Lucan chieftain stepped forth, eager to air his view.
They use the coastal city of Milawata as a bridgehead. They dream of taking all Anatolia, my son. As long as Troy stands in their way,
Alexandru thundered,
the states of Ahioa will never truly call Anatolian soil their own. You underestimate the Ahioans,
the Lucan chieftain replied curtly.
They make alliances with strange sea warriors from the distant dark western islands.
Alexandru's nose wrinkled.
Still, they will never best my navy.
Enough,
Massili said, a little more tersely than intended. I understand.
The south and east suffer the covetous eyes of the king of Assyria and the Egyptian pharaoh. The west is ripe for another rebellion. Invasion, even.
He sighed through his nose.
Now, the north.
He directed this question to a small, mop-haired, bearded, and pig-eyed man who hadn't spoken yet. This was Darazu, the Bel Madgalti, lord of the northern watchtowers. He wore a knee-length Hittite robe and nobleman's jewels in his ears, yet he was not a Hittite, but a Galasman, a small but pithy tribe who helped man the northern frontier and work the precious lead mines of those lands. While his father had been a stout master of those borders, Darazu was as yet unproven.
Pataga and the Kaskans are quiet, at least.
The truth was, those 12 mountain tribes were like a spear lodged in the northern flank of the Hittite realm. For generations they had called the Lost North their own. The once great Hittite cities of Hakmis, Zalpa, and Nerik had for too long lain in tumbled ruination, their gods disgraced, Kaskan mud-domed shantytowns erected amongst the fallen stones, their swines foraging amongst the tall grass that sprouted through the toppled temples. Too numerous to conquer, too devious to outmaneuver, the best a succession of Hittite kings could hope for was to contain the Kaskan threat. Darazu's nervous pause was enough to send Massili's heart plummeting.
Bel Madgalti, Massili reiterated. Of the north?
Darazu gulped.
Pitaga rises against you, my son. I tried to tell you before the gathering began.
Tell me now,
Massili demanded.
Darazu licked his dry lips. He struck the northern towers on the first days of spring. A stretch of the beacons and turrets have been toppled. I only knew of the breach when I smelt the smoke one morning. I watched them herding masses of Hittite families,
captured soldiers and droves of oxen and sheep back north, towards the pastures of Wahina.
You watched them? Masili said softly. From where?
From the fort city of Topeka. From my balcony.
Darazu stammered.
The polished stone balcony designed by my chief architect, Masili mused. High above and safely within Topeka's stout walls.
The Gallusman's face drained of colour, leaving just a red glow of embarrassment around his cheeks.
What of the garrison I provided you? 300 men and 20 chariots I stationed in Topeka, Masili said. Enough to ward off a few Kaskan raiding parties, surely.
This was not just a few raiding parties, my son. They moved like an army.
Masili glared at him, pressing for an answer to his original question.
I dispatched the garrison in pursuit of the Kaskan forces, Darazu said meekly. They were slaughtered. All of them.
Yet you survived, Masili observed dryly. Oh, I see.
You dispatched your forces, but remained on your balcony to watch and see how they would fare.
Brave, he said, curling his lower lip and nodding fiercely. Noble. Your father would have been proud.
I have failed you, my son.
Darazu bowed and dropped to one knee. The northern towers were breached. Men and beasts had been stripped from Hittite lands.
Masili almost felt the rupture in the vital defences like a gash in his own shoulder. Left to fester, infection would set in and soon spread. The Kaskans would return, probing further south. The heartland cities and their surrounding and precious crop meadows would suffer destruction and plunder. More men and herds would be lost. Famine and unrest would soon threaten.
Trouble burgeoned in every direction, it seemed.
The Hittite army, 20,000 strong and the dread of the battlefield when mustered in its entirety, could only be in one place at any time. That it consisted of four divisions was a playful bait, a tidy solution for a mind untrained in military matters. But to send a single division of his forces to each beset border would be akin to answering the wrathful roar of each enemy army with a yelp. No. The divisions of the Hittite army had to move as one and conquer united. Perhaps one division could be left behind to protect Hattusa. But what destination for the other three? To send the army west to crush the fresh troubles in those recently pacified lands, or to lead them southeast to ward off the bold pharaoh, or east to keep the Assyrians in check?
No. Only a fool would fight faraway demons when one hovers behind his back, he mused sultily.
The Kaskans were the most immediate of the great threats, with Pataga and the Mountain Men perched like black crows just north of the Hittite realm. There was no luxury of choice. He rose from his throne.
Before the summer is past, the pastures of Wahina will quake under our boots. Our captured people will be liberated and returned to their homes. Pataga and his Kaskans will be crushed. The Lord of the Mountains will become the Lord of Ashes and Bone.
He looked down at the kneeling Darazu.
And when we march, brave watcher from the balcony, you will march at our head.
Hattu, watching the discussion like a wary cat, hung on his father's words, just like the foreign kings. The Labana possessed an aura, a commanding backbone to his every word that made the room his own. To maintain such a presence in the face of so many doubtless shrewd individuals, Hattu thought, was surely the quality of a true king. He envied early signs of those same virtues in Mua, and bemoaned the lack of them in his own nature. But the moment of awe passed. He saw now what would happen in the coming days. Father, Mua, and the high generals would once again lead the divisions to war, a bronze beast that would crush the Kaskans and free the captive Hittites. And he saw his own future, in the quiet rooms of the scribal school. He sighed and turned away from the hall to face the night and the Acropolis ward, now rippling with increasingly drunken forms, the tables scattered with bones and crusts of bread.
He backed one leg down from the sill, stretching to find the thin gap between the stonework below, then worked his way down, silent and unseen, just as he had ascended, halting only to shoot a triumphant look at the two golden spearmen at the throne room doors, oblivious.
"Curse them, and the rest of the army. Herculers, one and all," he muttered.
A Hercula, one who engages in sexual congress with an animal, was the favourite curse word of the soldiers. At least it was the one Hattu always heard the Acropolis guards muttering under their breath when they were ordered to do some tedious or unwanted task.
"Aye, Herculus," he enthused.
A sense of smugness was just building, when something clamped around his shin and shook him like an earth tremor. He gasped and scrabbled to keep hold of the stonework, only to be torn from it. He fell his own height and crashed onto the red flagstones of the courtyard, winded and startled. Glowering down at him was a bald, one-eyed nightmare incarnate, scowling, inhuman, his single silver braid hanging like a whip.
"Corunta,"
he gasped in a whisper, shaking free of the man's grasp.
"We're all Herculers, you say?"
You?
Grunter mocked, his top lip twitching in disgust.
I didn't mean to cause any trouble, Hattu stammered.
Then you should have done as your father bid you, and stayed at the feasting tables. You were not invited to the talks, boy.
Hattu wilted under the general's gaze and blunt accent, which contrasted sharply against the more polished tones from the throne room.
You hate it when they call you that name, don't you?
Corunta spat, eyeing him with a scowl that showed every fine line on his face.
The cursed son.
Hattu felt the words like a stinging lash. He stood up and shot Corunta what he hoped was a fierce look.
If you hate it so much, then why do you persist in feats of idiocy like this?
He gestured sharply up and down the outer corner of the throne room walls.
Your father wants you to have no part in the affairs of the military. Don't you understand that? For your own good, boy, stay in the scribal school with that wittering old goose Ruba.
Corunta took a step towards him, radiating threat. Hattu took one step backwards, panicked. Corunta stamped a foot, flicked his head towards the palace, and issued a tss, as if chasing away an irritating cat. Hattu turned and ran, stifling hot tears of shame. Chapter 3. Land of Wraiths, Autumn 1303 BC. King Massili's heart thundered in anticipation of battle, his bronze scales clinking as he ran, his eyes fixed on the point where the grassy brow of the hill met the cloud-streaked Wahina sky, his mind conjuring the image of the Cascan force on the other side. The telltale glow of a fire had been sighted here during the night, and they had moved to close upon it even before dawn. It had been an arduous campaign, but Pitaga had been cornered at last. His warriors would be smashed, and the Hittite people he held captive would be liberated. Beside him, the eager Zeda and the trembling Darizu of Galasma stumbled along. Behind him came the Roth division. Up, up they went, with the dull clatter of spears rattling into place beside shields, the clicking of arrows being knocked to bows. Massili crested the banking first, his tall bronze battle helm catching the sunlight, spear in one hand and his battle blade in the other. He leapt over the brow, his long grey cloak trailing in his wake.
"May the gods rush before us!" he cried.
The wall of spearmen erupted in an echoing cry, and the skirling battle pipes exploded in a buzzing song of battle, only for the world to fall silent again. The cries faded, the rumble of boots died to nothing, the pipes sagged and fell quiet. Massili gazed across the barren field before him. Not a soul could be seen, just the charred remnant of a colossal campfire. A tremulous whisper of relief escaped Darizu's lips. Massili shot him a winter-cold look. Then, across the plain, a similar embryonic war cry rose from the woods there. The ranks of the Roth division bristled. Darizu wailed. Then many sighs and curses escaped as the Fury division burst from the trees and slowed, equally bemused. Prince Muwa, leading them, gazed at the smouldering bonfire and then across at his father. A third shrieking song of war erupted, and was swiftly cut short as the Blaze Division arrived on the western edge of the plain. General Nuanza, the strapping master archer and leader of the Blaze, cast his gaze across the empty plain. He shot Masili an exasperated and mildly reproachful look, and held out his palms to either side.
"Aye, Bowman. You were right. We should have waited for our scouts to report back first," he muttered.
A black plume of smoke and a trail of boot prints had lured them here. Their haste had been foolish in hindsight.
"Where are they?"
Zeta grunted, hurling his spear into the soft earth where it quivered, his red cloak swirling around him in the breeze.
"What are we hunting? Men or wraiths?"
Masili eyed the hoof and boot prints in the worn grass. A host of some sort had been through here recently. But who and how large, and where were they now? His eyes narrowed and he combed the horizon, suddenly feeling not like the lord of an avenging army, but like a rabbit in the sights of an archer.
"My son,"
Zeta said, his voice low. Masili turned to see his gal Mercedes lifting something from the ashes of the fire on the end of his spear. A string of blackened beads and a charred skull, brutally halved. The beads were Hittite. The skull had been split by a Kaskan axe. A chasm of an eye socket stared at him, and the teeth grinned horrifically. Some of the captured Hittites had found liberation of another kind. As night fell, Zeta and the Mercedes set about erecting the royal pavilion while the army marked out the camp and set up their bivouac tents. King Masili sat before a fire stocked with birchwood, his retinue alongside him. He looked into the embers and could not help but think of the grim find from earlier that day. His advisers had counted the remains of 80 charred bodies, a fraction of the people captured from Hittite lands. Where were the rest? Where was Pitaga? Somewhere deep inside his mind, he heard the Kaskan lord laugh long and loud.
"That is three false hopes dashed to pieces,"
Nuanza reasoned, chewing on a chunk of charred river bream on the end of a stick.
"They were at the lakeside village, apparently, until we got there and found nothing but abandoned huts and a lone captive hanging by his neck from the mast of a fishing boat. They were camped by the woods until we arrived and found only another captive staked through from groin to mouth and shorn of his tongue and guts. And today we risk disaster on the premise of a glow of fire in the night."
"Yet we have nothing else to go on," Prince Muwa mused.
"Then we should return to the heartlands, to Hattusa,"
Nuanza replied.
"Winter is but a single moon away, and the passes will soon be blocked with snow. It would be folly to maroon ourselves in these parts until spring."
A regimental chief from the Roth Division interrupted upon hearing this.
"And it would be dangerous to leave Hattusa in the hands of Kurunta One Eye for too long, my son."
Masili looked up and shot the man a long, silent glare that almost knocked the officer to his knees. Awkwardly, the man took his leave with some muffled excuse and a curt bow. Masili gazed into the flames, the man's meaning irking him. Kurunta's Storm Division, devoted to the almighty Tahunda, had been left in Hattusa to guard the capital and its approaches. A fool's choice, he had heard people whispering, for just one of the Storm's 5,000-strong regiments was mobilized, the men of the other four deemed too vital to be taken away from the otherwise undertended crop fields or from garrison duties in the other major heartland cities. Imprudent also, some had suggested, to leave the vengeful general in charge of the capital. From the depths of his mind, and despite his will to keep the memory suppressed, he recalled the sucking, squelching sounds of Kurunta's eye being scooped out, the animal grunts of the men pinning him to the ground and performing the punishment, and the utter silence of Kurunta himself. He closed his eyes, shaking the memory away.
"I cannot leave until I have found my people," Masili concluded. "It would be victory for Pitaga were we to return to Hattusa without having given him battle, or liberated those he shackled and led from our lands."
Darazu, the Galasman, sitting opposite the king, hung his head in shame.
Perhaps that's the way he wants you to think,
Nuanza reasoned, his eyes locked onto the fire, then switching suddenly to Masili.
You have sensed it too, my son, I know you have. A feeling of being toyed with? Last night, when we slept at the camp on the high plain, I lay awake and watched as a feral cat bounded back and forth with a mouse in its mouth. The mouse was fine, alive and all, but I could see in the tiny creature's black eyes that it knew that things were far from good. It is time to take the army home, my son.
Masili sighed. He had ignored Nuanza's words too often recently, and every time the shrewd general had been proven right. It was in an archer's nature, he realized, to wait, to measure, and never to shoot without absolute certainty of a clean strike.
Home, you say?
He said, breaking off a chunk of offered bread and chewing on it absently.
We have triumphed in part,
Zita added, stopping in his efforts to raise the tent.
We can detach 1,000 men, perhaps, to rebuild the broken watchtowers here, further north than before, to reclaim Wahina as our own.
Let us take the soil of Wahina as a blessing from the gods, and look to next year,
Muwa agreed.
The men are growing weary of this campaign, Father.
Masili looked around him, seeing that the ranks were not busy wrestling, drinking, and bantering as usual. Many sat in silence, way-worn and no doubt thinking of their loved ones. The balance of the argument was tilting, until he noticed a commotion near one end of the camp. A clutch of spearmen wrested a trio of men in from the darkness of night. Zida laid down his hammer and pegs, letting the part-erected pavilion slouch, taking up his spear instead.
"What's this?" he said keenly.
Masili rose, Nuanza and Muwa doing likewise. The king peered at the apparitions being brought to him. Three men with the heads of bulls, it seemed. An army of chill-footed ants raced across Masili's skin.
"What the—"
Prince Muwa gasped. But as they drew closer, the firelight showed them as no monsters. They were men, warriors, but in the oddest garb. To each of their helms were affixed two horns. The middle one of the three reeked of charisma and was clearly their leader. His eyes were pale blue, his skin fair, and his narrow nose and lips were almost sculpted. His hair was thick and flaxen like the noonday sun, tumbling from the back of that remarkable helm. He wore a green-painted, armless scale corslet, with a wide gold band clinging to his right bicep, and plate-sized copper rings dangled from his ears. He carried a fierce-looking trident, which Zida swiftly denuded him of as he was brought before Masili.
"My son," a Mercedes said. "The scouts found these three on the nearby hills. They were staked out by an ant's nest."
"A crawling death," Masili thought. One of the Kaskans' favoured ways of dispatching their enemies. A momentary silence gripped the crowds who had gathered round.
"This one asked for an audience with you,"
the Mercedes escorting them added, nodding to the central stranger. The leader of the odd trio's eyes widened as he beheld Masili.
"Lord of Hittite,"
he said in a jagged accent. Clearly the Hittite tongue was not his native language. Masili appraised the fellow for some clue of his origins, while Zida hissed in the newcomer's ear,
"Labana, great king of all you see around you. Now bow before him. You will address him as my son."
The stranger obediently sank to one knee, dipping his head.
"My son," he said, "I am Volker, from the island of Sherden."
Masili's eyes narrowed. Nuanza leaned in close to whisper.
"The Sherden, a tribe from far, far to the west, beyond Troy, beyond even the dark islands of Ahioa. I've only heard traders and adventurers speak of them before."
Volker looked up at Nuanza now.
"This true. You only pass the
Ahiawan coastlands near end of journey to get here.
The throaty hiss and the way he pronounced Ahiawan led a mystical air to his words and seemed to chill the night just a fraction.
My men and I travel long, long way to come to my son. Sailed towards the dawn for many moons.
He swept a hand across the sky as if outlining their voyage.
A mercenary? Did King Alexandru not warn us of his like?
Mua whispered.
The sea warriors from the faraway western islands?
The slightest twinge on Volker's lips suggested he had heard and understood this.
Some of Sheridan are pirates. This true,
he agreed, the copper rings in his ears jangling as he spoke.
But I am not. I carry trident, not cutthroat dagger. Indeed, I loathe sight of blood.
He grinned, his teeth shining like the gold band on his arm.
Particularly my own.
What do you ask of me? Massili said.
Bread, and broth, and the chance to serve a good king. Nothing more.
He held out a hand either side to his two companions.
I bring you no treasure or army, but I hope to offer you knowledge and advice.
Zeta laughed a single barking laugh.
What can you tell the great king of the Hittites about his own realm?
Volker shrugged.
I know where Kaskan army is. They were ones who tied me and my men to ant's nest.
Silence. 1,000 captive breaths.
My son, now is not the time to change your thinking, Nuanza started. You are on the verge of ordering the march ho-
Nasili held up a hand, cutting him off, then crouched to be level with the kneeling Volker.
Tell me.
Chapter 4. From the Soaring Mountains. Autumn 1303 BC. Hattu took Atiyah's hand as they edged sideways along the narrow shelf of rock, halfway up a silvery crescent of bluffs, a few dana north of Hattusa. He glanced up, seeing on the cliff wall a giant and bold etching of the Haga, a mighty two-headed eagle, a stamp of Hittite power, a symbol of heroes. The sight sent a frisson of excitement through him. They were nearly there. His climbs and ventures like this had been a much-needed contrast to what had been a quiet spring, summer, and autumn in the scribal school, like gold thread in a dull grey garment. The fresh morning wind cast up a playful russet storm of leaves on the ground, the height of four men below, causing Atiyah to whimper.
"Don't look down," he whispered, squeezing her hand. "Look at me."
She gulped and smiled, her free hand switching from the rocky wall at their backs to her red headscarf, which the wind threatened to steal away.
"You promised me wonderful things, Hattu,"
she said with a tremor in her voice.
"This isn't quite what I expected. This isn't what I meant. You'll see soon, I promise,"
he smiled. Within a few steps, the ledge widened, and there was a small gap in the cliff wall at their backs, as if a giant stonemason had chiseled into the stony redoubt. Atiyah gasped, turning, peering through the gap.
"What is it?"
she whispered.
"It is invisible to the eye from the ground. I only found it when I last came out to climb,"
Hattu winked, then took her hand and edged through the gap, leading her with him. The tight gap became a narrow corridor, through which their every footstep echoed. The corridor widened and then yawned open to reveal a round, green, stone-walled hollow, like a giant washing bowl, sheltered from the autumn winds high above, but open to the sun's heat. Dust boats floated languorously in the air as he led her across the soft, lush grass on the hollow floor. He let Atiyah's hand slip from his and watched as she walked almost on her toes, turning, eyes drinking in the scene. At the far end of the hollow, a tall terraced waterfall fell in sleek, glossy sheets over smooth stone into a cerulean tarn. A fine mist rose from the fall, iridescent halos of sunlight growing and changing in the air before them. Dragonflies hovered just above the water's surface, capriciously darting from one spot to another. The pebble-smooth banks of the tarn shimmered in the sunlight, and where it was wet, patches of glistening lichen had grown in delicate shades of sorrel and cream. Cherry trees and honey-scented broom lined the edges of the water. But the real wonder lay up above.
"Look," he said.
She tilted her head back and looked up with him. Hawks, falcons, and eagles banked and soared in the zephyrs, plunging down into the hollow, then swinging up again.
"Wondrous, isn't it?"
Hattu grinned.
"I dream of such places,"
Atiya whispered.
"So beautiful."
"Aye, it is," Hattu agreed, his eyes on Atiya. With a flutter of wings, Arrow swept into the hollow and came to a rest on Hattu's bracer, then looked up at the heavenly dance.
"Are the big birds putting you to shame?"
Atiya teased Arrow. Arrow extended and shook her wings in impotent fury.
"She can swoop and dart with the best of them," Hattu laughed, linking arms with Atiya and coaxing Arrow onto her wrist.
"When she was a nestling, I taught her to hunt," he said, unravelling a long ribbon of light-coloured linen and tying one end around a fat earthworm. Holding the other end, he ran until the linen billowed up into the air behind him. Arrow's head dipped, her eyes locked onto the prize on the ribbon's end. She shot off to catch it, only for Hattu to sweep his hand sharply, bringing the floating ribbon round and away, the worm safe. Arrow keened in disgust, but did not give up the chase. Round and round they went before the falcon got her prize. Next, Atiya took a turn. Hattu stood behind her, guiding her arms to hold the ribbon correctly, then running with her.
"Now flick your hand up and... yes!"
Atiya squealed with delight as the ribbon fluttered and leapt up into the air. She spun and ran, leading Arrow in a merry dance. At noon, they sat on a carpet of soft moss. Hattu lit a small fire to cook a rabbit, and they ate it with flatbread and drank berry juice, watching the concert in the sky. Arrow joined the winged masses above, and they talked of simple things, of silly stories from past play, of dreams for the future. She told him how the elder priestess at the Storm Temple had hinted that she might one day be appointed the keeper of the holy silver effigy of Tahunda. He recited for her part of the Epic of Gilgamesh. When at last they fell silent, Hattu gazed wistfully northeast. Atiya once again read him like a tablet.
"The king and Muwa will return from Wahina unharmed. I'm sure of it," she said.
Hattu felt ashamed for a moment. In truth, he had been thinking not only of their welfare, but of the injustice of it all. Left behind again, while father and Muwa chased glory in distant lands. She squeezed his arm, then gazed through the corridor of rock in the rough direction of Hattusa.
"Aye, we should be getting back," he mused.
After edging off the cliffs, they made their way across the exposed hills, the fresh autumn wind buffeting them again. About half a danna away from Hattusa, they passed the great rock shrine. The place resembled an ancient crown of grey stone, pushed through the earth from below, its sides etched with scenes of the gods. The ring of natural fin-like shards sheltered a small and very sacred area within, where kings were buried, where gods were honoured, where high-born men and women were joined in marriage. He unconsciously reached out and took Atiya's hand. Arrow, following, came swooping down and landed on his shoulder, shrieking.
"Food? You've eaten plenty. Any more and you won't be able to take flight."
Yet on she shrieked, not at him, but at the sky behind.
"What's wrong?"
Hattu cooed. He glanced back, but saw nothing. Ahead, the bulky outline of Hattusa rose into view. The outlying croplands were nearly deserted for the coming winter, with just a few farmers busy repairing their homes. One man was sitting on the roof of his mud-brick home with his three-legged dog, enjoying the heat from a small brazier. The fields themselves were stripped bare, the grain having been carted into the city and stored in the pits atop Tahunda's shoulder, the smaller tor opposite the Acropolis Mount. Without warning, Atea halted, looking whence they had come.
Atea?
Hattu whispered.
Something is out there,
she said, agitated like Arrow.
We're alone, he reassured her.
The cool wind did its best to convince him otherwise. Hattu took her hand again, carrying on towards Hattusa at a faster pace. He could not help but look back once more at the still and silent north, bleak hills and skeletal alder woods, deserted. Suddenly a loud, deep clang of bronze shuddered across the sky from Hattusa, the warning bell, a harbinger of some grave threat to the city. He had only heard it once before, some 8 years ago. Then he had been within Hattusa's walls, and it had come to nothing.
Hattu,
Atea wailed, looking all around. Suddenly the few people outside the city walls took flight, throwing down tools and bolting towards the Tawinian gate, well ahead of Hattu and Atea. Arrow shrieked and leapt into flight, swooping towards Hattusa and coming back again in circles, as if urging them on. Clang! Hattu saw the few sentries on Hattusa's northern walls pointing, gesticulating to the north, shouting to one another. He and Atea broke towards the city in a stumbling half-run, Hattu looking back in the direction of this unseen threat. A sharp pain shot through his smoke-grey eye, and suddenly he saw everything a little more clearly.
"What's happening, Hattu?"
Atea quailed as they ran.
"There's something in the woods,"
he gasped, turning to run backwards. Then he saw the strangest thing emerging from the trees. Many hundreds of bobbing heads. Heads with long, flowing black hair, some with leather Hittite helms on.
"Our soldiers?"
he panted, unconsciously slowing. But something was wrong with the sight. The heads bobbed high, higher than any man. When he saw the red ribbons of flesh and sinew that dangled from the neck of one of the heads, the riddle was solved. Hittite heads, right enough, severed and affixed on top of spears like grim totems. Just then, the woods spewed forth a landslip of shapes, mountain warriors festooned with bronze and copper axes, swords and those foul spears.
Kaskans,
Hattu gasped, seeing the many screaming mouths, manes of shaggy tousled hair, unkempt beards and faces daubed with hideous bright streaks or handprints. They wore fleeces or rough woolen capes on their shoulders, with leather corslets and caps or headbands of brightly dyed wool.
How could it be?
Pitaga and the Kaskans were in Wahina right now, being dealt with by the Hittite army, were they not? This host numbered too many to count, and many more than the 1,000 soldiers of the storm housed in Hattusa's great barracks. They swung and waved their weapons in the air like a bronze crop field, and they brought many rudimentary ladders with them, tall enough to scale Hattusa's walls.
Run!
Hattu stammered, suddenly swinging to face the city and speeding up.
Run! Run!
He and Atea now broke into a headlong dash towards the Tawinian gatehouse, its heavy gates still wide open, the smattering of Hittite sentries there in disorder. Yet the gates seemed so far away, and the Kaskans were bearing down on them like stampeding bulls.
Clang!
The great bell tolled again, shaking the earth. Then came the cry of the mountain men, as the Kaskans came to within a few hundred paces of the city and broke into a fervent charge, and a terrible wail erupted from what sounded like a Kaskan ibex horn, low like a demon's growl, then suddenly and jarringly high and deafening.
Clang!
The great bell of Hattusa sounded in reply, this time barely audible over the Kaskan horn. Hattu and Atea sped, hand in hand towards the Tawinian gatehouse. But they were greeted with the sight of the last few field workers scrambling inside before the bronze-strapped gates swung shut and heard the thick clunk of the locking bar within being lowered into place. He, Atea, and the three-legged farm dog were alone outside in the shadow of the gate, like cornered sheep. Upon the battlements, a sentry looked down on them, his face draining of blood when he realized what had happened.
It's the cursed... It's Prince Hattu! Prince Hattu's outside,
he yelled. But the few others on the walls barely heard, perhaps even chose not to, running to and fro, tossing spears and shields out across the battlements from the tower guard rooms.
Open the gates,
Atea cried, as the din of the onrushing Kaskans seemed to swell up behind them.
Those gates will not open now. Not for anyone. Come,
Hattu said, twisting towards the small triangular alcove dug into the bedrock under the walls, just left of the Tawinian gates. All had been taught well the location and purpose of the postern tunnels around the city, wide enough for a single man to pass in or out, or a boy and a girl. But he felt Atiyah's hand slipping from his, and with a twist of her ankle and a cry, she fell. Hattu swung round, his hair sweeping across his face, the smoke-grey eye sharp like a blade on her, sprawled a few paces back. The swell of Kaskan warriors coursed towards her. She was struggling to rise, her face gaunt, terrified, mouth open, wordless in panic, eyes screaming for help. The foremost of the charging Kaskans, a red-bearded monster of a warrior, was bounding in her direction, just 30 paces distant, a fire-hardened club gripped and readied to stave in her head.
"Prince Hattu!"
the sentry shouted down from the walls.
"Get into the postern tunnel now!"
Hattu twisted to the dark postern burrow and the small triangle of light at the far end. Safety within the walls beckoned. His smoke-grey eye ached again, and he made out a shape through there, momentarily, a figure, part silhouetted, a slender, aged man with odd eyes, wearing scribe's robes, shoulders rounded and head hung in timidity, alone. When he swung back to Atiyah, there was another figure. Hattu started. A stranger. Back turned to him, facing her and the Kaskans. Tall, broad, draped in a magnificent green cloak, crowned with a warrior's helm. He lurched towards Atiyah, hoping the stranger might help him save her. He stooped swiftly to pick up a hand-sized pitted rock as some means of defence. When he rose and bounded on, the stranger was gone, just as a shadow might vanish with the coming of the sun. It was just him and Atiyah outside Hattusa's walls, with a multitude